Hey, y'all. The Fallen Podcast is an Augusta University and Georgia Cyber Center production. Thanks for tuning in. Things are about to get wild. Augusta University is proud to celebrate Black History Month. To celebrate, we want to take a moment to recognize student organizations that help create Black history for the university. Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated was nationally founded on January 16, 1920 at Howard University in Washington, D.C. by five founders, also known as the Five Pearls, with the help of two founders of Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity Incorporated. The oh-so-sophisticated Sigma Rho chapter of Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated was chartered at Augusta University on September 9, 2002 by six members known as the Delightful Six. The ladies of the Sigma Rho chapter are dedicated to their charter members' legacy of maintaining Zeta Phi Beta's purpose of fostering the ideals of service, charity, scholarship, civic and cultural endeavors, sisterhood, and finer womanhood.
Welcome to In the Wild. Each week, we're catching you up with all things Augusta University with our most trusted and wildest voices on campus. Here's your host, Rayshawn Ricks.
What's up, y'all? Welcome to In the Wild. I am your host, Rayshawn Ricks, and in the studio, we have our amazing intern, Miss Ania Clark. How's it going?
It is going well. It's been a busy month, and February is almost gone. Like, I feel like it just started, but overall, life is going pretty well. What about you?
It's been busy. It has been really busy. Just kind of coming up with all the interesting ideas we got going on for the podcast. It really has me, like... feeling energized, because, you know, earlier this week we was talking about some stuff that we got for the rest of the semester. So y'all stay tuned, because we got some really cool stuff coming out in the works. But it's Black History Month. Yes. And for those that have been listening all month, you know that we have been celebrating Black History Month. And today is our Black History Month episode. And for those that are curious, why are we still talking about Black History Month? Or why do we go so hard for Black History Month? And it's a purpose, because historically, Black people have been erased or kind of removed from American history. Mm-hmm. So being able to take just, unfortunately, the shortest month of the year, but
exactly.
a month to kind of reinsert ourselves into our own history, especially American history, because of how, you know, our origins for being here got started. But yeah. I guess just passing off to you, Ania, what does Black History Month mean to you?
Well, Black History Month to me means a lot of things. I think one of the first, you know, reasons I was taught why we celebrate Black History Month is to celebrate the achievements that, you know, African Americans have done, a lot of first things that, you know, African Americans have done, and the progress we have made. You know, at one point in time, we weren't even allowed to vote. And when we were allowed to vote, you know, they made it very hard for us. We had to pass these crazy tests. And I mean, you know, going back to slavery, you know, how we didn't have rights. So we've come a long way. And I think this month is just a month to, you know, reflect on that and reflect on the progress that we've made as African Americans, and also to, you know, think about where we go from now, you know, how we can continue the progress and continue the success for African Americans. So, you know, Black History Month is just a celebration of Black people.
And, you know, we celebrate 365 days a year, but taking a moment in terms of the podcast, at least being able to honor people that have dedicated their lives.
Paved the way for us.
Yeah, because that's really important, because as a Black person, I often think of the sacrifices that generations made before me, from moments that my ancestors were slaves up into just like my mom and her generation, because they experienced things that fortunately we will never have to experience. Mm-hmm. And I think I talked about this on the podcast before, but my high school was one of the last high schools in the country to desegregate their prom.
Whoa.
Yeah. So for me, when I think about Black History Month and race and how race plays a role in society and all of those constructs, like, that's automatically, like, my first thing that I think of, like, when I was, right before I got a chance to go to prom, is when our school started having a integrated prom. Like, and for us, it was normalized. Even mm-hmm. in the 2010s era, because I'm not that old, like, for us, that was normal. It was like, okay, there's the white prom and there's the black prom, and like, that was just that. Like, that's just what we do. We don't want to go to the white prom because it doesn't fit our vibe. They're not gonna have the same music. They're not gonna have the same sort of themes and things that we could relate to. Like, culturally, we wouldn't fit in. Yeah. Right. And then they felt the same way about our prom. And for, like I said, for us, that was completely normalized. And it wasn't until someone actually brings up that question, like, that, like, that's weird. Like, don't nobody even, like, this is 2000, like, this is 2010. Y'all are telling me this is y'all's first integrated prom?
Yeah.
We go to school together. We go to class together. We hang out together outside of class. But when it comes to that one night, it was like, oh, like, no, we don't. So,
yeah. How did they, like, let that go on for so long? Because in schools, they have, like, the Title X, like, you know, they don't, you know, practice discriminatory practices. So that's kind of crazy to me that, you know, in 2010, this is the first integrated prom. Like, that's crazy to me.
2000, I could be wrong, but... Yeah, I want to say 2010 was the first integrated prom my high school had experienced.
Yeah, that wasn't too long ago. So it's 2022 now. So if that just happened not too long ago, you know, we still got work to do. That just shows we still have work to do. Like, we're not done.
and just to kind of talk about my hometown for a minute, just think, like, culturally, if we're still at a point of it's okay that we have segregated proms, think about all the other topics stuff that comes into race and society and social justice that we're just decades behind, because we're decades behind with just integrating social events.
Yeah, like other events that just haven't been talked about, like, you know, hair in the workplace and in school. Yeah. We're just now addressing, like, okay, it's okay for kids to wear locks to school or wear their afros to school, or I'm not going to be asked to go home because I'm at work with my afro out. You know, now you're seeing, wear your braids to work. Wear your afro to work. It's beautiful. But, you know, not too long ago, you had to basically wear your hair straight to work to conform to the, you know, workplace you were at. So it just goes to show how much, and now you see diversity and inclusion is just so big right now in a lot of organizations. Mm-hmm. It's like the top priority. And to me, it kind of makes me think.
Or they say it's the top priority.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was about to go into. Like, I think about it and I say, is it really genuine? Like, do you guys really want to be diverse and inclusive? Or is it just so you can, you know, make money?
Yeah, and going back to talking about hair, because, you know, all month we've been hashtagging share your hair. So for those that haven't already, please participate. And check out our Instagram to learn all about that, because Ania did an amazing job with that this month. But
thank you.
You're welcome. But yeah, like, that's something that I think other cultures don't even have to think about is textured hair. Like, other cultures or people with non-textured hair, like, they are not only comfortable, but they do without experiencing anything. Like, if they can come to work with their hair wet, or they can come if it's curly or straight or however it comes out of their natural head that day, like, it's fine for them. But for black women, and particularly black women that have very textured hair, it's completely different experience.
Yeah, because I remember just, like, me being in middle school, there weren't nearly as many products for textured hair as it is now. Like, it's all over the shelves and stores like Walmart and Target. Like, there's a big push to being inclusive with hair products, and I love it. But, you know, again, it just goes to show, like, how far we've come and, like, the work we still have to do. like Camille Rose, I think, I don't know if she's like one of the newer brands, but like she's a very popular brand. I use her, by the way.
I use her too.
You do? I love her. It smells good, works good. But I think she's like one of the newer black owned hair product brands out there now who, you know, formulates her products for texture hair. Mm-hmm. So, like, I used to use Cantu, but I found out it was not black owned. It's not black owned. Mm-mm. So, it
and it's not the best product either.
When I first, but now it's like water. I put on my hair; it doesn't even do anything. But see, I appreciate brands like Camille Rose, and there's another one I forgot. It's like in a pink bottle. It's like dark pink. I forgot her name. I think she's kind of part Hispanic as well.
Okay.
Miel products.
I use that too.
Yes. So yeah, those brands, you see, they are coming out with these products to, you know, for texture hair. And yep. I love that. I love that push towards being inclusive to texture hair.
Yeah. Just knowing that, looking at Black History Month, there's so much progress that we can celebrate, mm-hmm. but there's also still a lot of work to do in terms yeah. of really making every individual feel included, welcomed, and I guess safe.
Safe, definitely.
Is a big part. And for this episode, we're really excited to talk to two amazing men that not only just contributed to Black history, but very specifically to Augusta University and the Medical College of Georgia's history. So stay tuned, and y'all gonna hear from them real soon.
Augusta University is proud to celebrate Black History Month. To celebrate, we want to take a moment to recognize student organizations that created Black history for the university. On November 11, 2001, six men exemplified the ideals of brotherhood, scholarship, and service and chartered the Beta Beta Gamma chapter of Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity, Incorporated, on the campus of Augusta University. Since their charter date, the brothers of the Beta Beta Gamma chapter have excelled in the three ideals of brotherhood, scholarship, and service. They continue to strive for excellence by strengthening the brotherhood, servicing the community, and excelling in scholarship.
Welcome back, y'all, to In the Wild. And joining us is a very special guest. He is Professor Emeritus and former chair of the Department of Family Medicine and the voice of GPB's The Medical Minute. He has contributed a lot to Augusta University and specifically the Medical College of Georgia, in terms of Black history and everything else. So give a warm Jaguar welcome to Dr. Joseph Hobbs. How's it going?
Great. Glad to be here.
We're so happy to have you here. So thank you so much for taking a bit of your day to come chat with us. And just diving right in, campus has changed a lot since you were a student here. What first comes to mind when you think about your time as a student here?
Well, that was back in 1970 when I arrived on campus for the first time. And I say that a little odd because I'm an Augustan, lifelong Augustan. So I've had contact with the Medical College of Georgia for most of my life, including starting in the ninth grade on.
Oh, wow.
So I knew about the college and things like that. So the thing that if we're looking at the campus per se, it was a much smaller campus. It was the research building, which was the Sanders building that was across from the administration building, actually was built and completed while I was there as a medical student. And so it was probably the first piece of large construction that had occurred on campus for some time at that point. The Talmadge Hospital was called the Talmadge Hospital at that point. For the most part, the campus was not a campus. There were some on-campus housing at that point in time, which I took advantage of, because although I was an Augustan, my mom did not think that it was appropriate for me to stay at home since I was, I was supposed to be an adult, so I actually stayed on campus, which ended up being a nice experience. It was a small residential hall on campus. That was it. So once you left class, all of the class itself dispersed, and you probably didn't see them again until the class got back together for another formal meeting in class and things like that. So so it did not have, having come from a small liberal arts university like Mercer in Macon, it didn't have that nice, comfortable campus feel to it. It was more kind of, the medical school was kind of an adjunct to the hospital. That's kind of the feeling that you got and things like that. And as a young undergraduate medical student, when we got there, there were not a lot of people who looked like me who were on campus at that point in time. In fact, there were only, if I'm not mistaken, there were only four people of color who had been admitted to the medical school at that point in time. In the class that I was in, this is the class of 1970, there were seven of us. And we were the result of a pretty extensive recruitment effort on the college's part to kind of respond to the need to desegregate the school, you know, because basically up until 1967, the school had been segregated. And as a young high school student in this town, working with some of the researchers here at the Medical College of Georgia, I was fully aware that I couldn't come here to school. I knew that. In fact, the presence of the first black medical students actually occurred, I think I was in the 1967, I was in my sophomore year at Mercer when I began to be aware of that. And it was really at that point in time when coming here became a part of the calculus that I was using to make some decisions about what I was going to do for my next level of education. The other thing that was kind of odd about coming here at that point was that although I was one of a handful of black medical students, the desegregation process was occurring kind of across the colleges. So there were nursing students in numbers that had not been here before. There were allied health science students in numbers that had not been here before. So my guess is if you put all those numbers together, you may have had 30 or so people of color who were kind of in the beginning classes in those various schools. And that kind of gave you a kind of a sense of a small community brought together because you were minority students here for the first time. Within that group, I think we develop a sense of purpose to help each other out, you know, to navigate a new system that was new to us and probably new to everybody that we ran into, students and faculty alike, you know, concerned about the fact that they may have had preconceived ideas about our right to be here, you know, and how did we make those unfortunate prejudices go away by doing well. So a lot of academic support in that small group and things like that to make sure that everybody was successful and things of that sort. The other thing that was kind of odd about it is that having been at Mercer, Mercer had gone through the same process about 4 years earlier when it brought new black students to the campus. When we got to Mercer, small number of black students at Mercer, no significant black staff to speak of. And outside of the lunchroom, you know, you didn't see people of color. Even the people on the grounds, you know, for the most part were not people of color. But MCG was different. It was a hospital. And there were just a bunch of black people here. Now, they didn't work in the higher levels of the organization and things like this. They were grounds people. They were custodians. They were nursing assistants. A lot of people doing the heavy legwork of the hospital, and to some extent the medical school, and those numbers were substantial. And so, the fact of walking across campus, you did not get the sense that you were an isolated minority. You may have been a small part of a small minority class, but there were a lot of people there, and they were happy to see us there. So it was, you know, you could walk across campus, you run into somebody, whether it's a nursing assistant or a nurse or someone who worked in food services or something like this, and basically, how did your day go today? Mm. Hello, how you doing? invite you to their church, things of this nature. So there was an outreach of the staff of that environment that made the transition into that setting less confrontational and things like that. I think that the size of that class was 136 students in the freshman class, compared to the day where it's 260 students in the freshman class. So, and then a surprisingly a high number of African Americans in that class. So there are support structures there. There's kind of, you know, I think that the system understands a little bit about the challenges that people of color might have in an environment like this. And so a lot of support structure and things of this nature. For the most part, at that time, the school was flying by the seat of its pants, no experience, things like that, you know. And it was a lot of efforts to try to support that probably were not as effective as they should have been, but it was a part of a growing experience of the college trying to reorient itself once the barriers of racism had permitted the school to do what should have been done all along, which was to desegregate. So a class that had little diversity, the class that we have now is very diverse, although if we look at underrepresented minorities, that number still is not adequate. But there are a lot of other people here that creates a diverse class and things like this. And that wasn't the way it was when we came here to medical school.
Yeah, I was curious about the resources that y'all had, because like you mentioned, you know, in today's time, we have a lot of committees and individuals that are, you know, tasked to ensure diversity. So what was that like in being in such a small group without, you know, having those representatives and those people there?
Well, first of all, some of us had already been in situations like this in undergraduate school. When I went to Mercer, our class was 16 people out of 500, and there had been only five black students there before we had gotten there. So I spent that whole 4 years kind of acclimating to an environment like this. And quickly what we did is that we felt as students we needed to organize. So we created the Black Student Alliance. And the Black Student Alliance was kind of the way in which black students organized themselves on campus and address, you know, support among students and things like this, brought issues to the administration regarding, you know, our matriculation there and things of this nature. So when we got to MCG, when I got to MCG, the first thing that we did is that we created the Black Student Medical Alliance to create that same sort of group support, group awareness, and to try to have an organization that could provide input to the administration about things that we felt needed to be done to address the appropriate integration, if you would, of black students into the campus community and to the experiences that all students should have. So that was the thing that we attempted to do to try to create that. Now, there was a small cohort of faculty who were progressive enough to kind of realize that there could be difficulties. So there were people, you know, and right now I probably could name them because, you know, that list would probably not exceed much more than 10 to 15 individuals. Not to suggest that other people were not concerned, but these people were overtly concerned and overtly reached out to us. But more importantly, even though these people were not a part of the Medical College of Georgia, the physicians, dentists, and pharmacists of the Stony Medical Dental Pharmaceutical Society, which was the counterpart to the Richmond County Medical Society that was created because blacks could not get access to the county, Richmond County Medical Society, because it was segregated, they reached out. I mean, I can even sit here and close my eyes and I can tell you, I could describe their family rooms because they had us to their homes on many occasions for the purposes of socializing with us, you know, letting us know that, that you know, what could happen at the end of this journey and things like this. And the fact that they had achieved their degrees under much more difficult circumstances and things like that. And their support and their encouragement was unbelievable. The other piece of this is that of the staff that was at the Medical College of Georgia, I have to go back and just applaud the nursing staff, many of whom were products of the old Lamar School of Nursing, which produced the body of black nurses for this entire region and things like this. They were another group that did not officially reach out to us, but they had our backs. You know, to be on a clinical service and to have, you know, a nursing assistant or a nurse tap you on the shoulder and says, they're going on rounds and they haven't told you.
Oh, you know, wow.
Just to kind of keep you on your toes and things like that, to be involved and be concerned about you, trying to make sure that your transition into the clinical environment worked well. I mean, they were just, they were amazing.
And that seemed to, I mean, have a big impact on you because you spent your career here.
Yes.
So why do you think you, well, like what kept you around for all of these years?
Well, accident, because truly, when I finished my family medicine residency, I was looking for a job, trying to figure out a place to go. And one of the challenges that we had at that point in time is that if you looked at the practices here in town, they were segregated practices. And when I say segregated, not officially segregated, but they were all white or they were all black. The black practices, for the most part, were solo physicians. And their ability to support a partner at that point in time was not possible. So what it meant for me is that I had to look for opportunities beyond here for practice and things of that nature. So what happened is as I'm exploring practice opportunities elsewhere, the chair of the Department of Family Medicine at that point in time, a guy by the name of John Calvert, called me into his office. I had been the chief resident for the department in my senior year, in my third year there. And he asked if I wanted to consider a faculty position. So I thought about it, and if I kind of look at the thing that has actually driven me from a career standpoint, it's always been my desire to be in a profession where I had the opportunity to teach others. And although being a physician, you're teaching patients on a day-by-day basis, this idea of being a part of to be a physician and also be in a role where you had formal access to teaching learners and things like this was intriguing. And so since I was having challenges with regards to finding practice partners and things like this, I thought that, well, I'll give this a couple of years and see how this works. You know, and it'll give me some time to kind of go after this other opportunity of full-fledged practice on a more deliberate level and things like that. And quite frankly, in about a year and a half, I was smitten with the bug to be an academic faculty member. I was given kind of early in my career there an opportunity to run the family medicine residency program, to direct the inpatient service and things like that. And these were very, very stimulating environments to be in, to be able to be a provider of care to individual patients, and to also layer on top of that an opportunity to teach learners about the appropriate care of patients both inside the hospital and outside of the hospitals as well.
Did you notice a difference from your experiences as you continued on into your career?
Difference in what way?
In terms of, I guess, from how the leadership and administration may have looked at you as a student, but then coming into as still being a minority into, I guess, as a professional.
Well, I would think that at every level, there's going to be some learning curve. And when I joined the faculty, I was one of three of the first full-time faculty members. So yet again, you know, you're kind of caught in a situation where you're coming into an environment that is not socialized for you yet and things like that. And so this was a learning environment for everybody. How do I, you know, where are my mentors? And they didn't naturally occur. You know, I had to kind of seek them out and things of this nature, had to develop relationships. It was not organic initially. And I think that for me, the biggest part of that made this work for me was I found myself eventually working in the department for a chair. His name was Joseph Tolleson, who was just unbelievably outstanding, had a good understanding of the challenges that underrepresented minorities would face in environments like this, and was extremely supportive, and was probably the major part of the external advocacy for my career development here. So I would think that without a Joseph Tolleson, this story would have been shorter.
Oh, wow.
Because he gave me some opportunities to do things that would not have naturally occurred. Now, being in a department like Family Medicine, which is a new department, kind of developing itself, the opportunities to be engaged in a lot of new projects was substantial. But the fact that I was given opportunities to explore the unexplored, at least for this medical school, you know, it was just an amazing sort of arrangement. In fact, I'm probably known around campus as being the guy who puts together external educational networks of medical students. Well, that occurred because Tolleson gave me the opportunity to create the first educational network statewide to support our clerkship environment. And that's kind of where it started. It also gave me an opportunity not only to teach, to see patients, it also gave me an opportunity to do educational research as well. So it was a great opportunity in spite of the expected challenges that you'd have in a new organization that's, you know, trying to project itself as being much more inclusive, much more diverse, and things like that.
So I know you talked about you set up networking opportunities for students.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you go about doing that?
Well, I have this fundamental belief that that what we teach in an academic setting is not something that's exclusive to us. Mm-hmm. That if we could find people out in the field, working in the field, that they have a lot of education that they can offer to students. I just always felt that way. It's one thing to have someone who teaches it, but if they don't do it every day, then maybe they don't get the sense of the holistic approach to the care that patients need in that setting. And so what we did is that we began a process of interviewing physician practices across the state. And after that review, we found some practices that we thought had all of the educational potential, in fact, greater educational potential than what could be provided at MCG, because for us, we were in primary care, and MCG being a tertiary center, the primary care opportunities were small there. But these were fine physicians, important parts of their community, willing to volunteer their services to teach medical students because they wanted to convince students to do what they were doing. And putting that together was very important. Now, I can't take credit for the network that was created, because the network that was created, the way that we did this was that there was a retired family medicine faculty member who was with us. His name was Olin Wilson. His concept was you got to let them build the system. You got to take off the academic arrogance. Let them build your system for you. They need to have ownership. And that's the way that we approach this process. And the network still stands today. And it's probably one of the more stable educational networks that exists within the whole Medical College of Georgia, basically because those individuals, they're community physicians, part of the faculty, but they're in their private practices. They believe, truly believe, and I believe that they do, own those student experiences, that they are responsible for them, and they do an excellent job of making that work.
How does that feel, knowing that something that you worked on still exists and still has great impact on today's future doctors?
Good. Very good. Yeah. However, I have to kind of always go back and share the fact that, you know, I was kind of like the orchestra leader, you know. That's all I did, you know, the baton, and that's all that I did. They did the heavy work, you know, and part of it was letting them truly become a part of our academic community. And, I mean, in fact, we were having students in those early days in places where we were concerned about how well the medical student, who was a minority, would fit into these rural communities. So what do? We discuss this openly with, most of these were white physicians. We discuss this problem openly with them. How are you going to, I mean, we can't discriminate. We can't send you all white students. We have to send you whatever the lottery provides for you. How are you going to make sure that this works? And quite frankly, they did the heavy lifting of making it work. They believed that if they use their status as a physician, that they walked into an examining room and the student they were working with was a minority student, that by his very presence with them, that he could give validity to the appropriateness of him being there. And in the years that we ran that I was responsible for the program, we got a lot of pushback about problems at the sites, but not that one, which to me was just fascinating that these people were very, very actively engaged in making sure that those students, regardless of creed or color, had excellent experiences in those settings and helping their patients understand the benefit of a diverse and inclusive environment as well.
Were there times when, you know, you reached out to these physicians for networking opportunities that they just kind of like downright declined or just said like, we don't want to work with you or because of your color or because, you know, with everything just going on with, you know, trying to be more inclusive, were there times where they just didn't want to work with you?
People may find this answer odd, but the answer to that is no. I was really, and I think a little bit of it that helped me was that I can't tell you what the politics of those physicians were at the time. Mm-hmm. But I think that what the chair did is that the chair kind of clothed me in the authority of the Medical College of Georgia and its Department of Family Medicine. So when I walked in, the fact that I was black may have shocked them, but I was the representative of the Medical College of Georgia. And under those circumstances, it gave me the authority to have these sorts of discussions with them. Mm-hmm. And if there was a problem, I think that reasonable people over time, that those problems would probably evaporate. But no, never had a person who said no because I got the sense that it was part of, you know, that it was my ethnicity that was creating that sort of problem. Now, could that have existed under the surface? The answer to that is absolutely yes. Mm-hmm. But the relationship that these physicians felt that they wanted with the Medical College of Georgia appeared to supersede that. And I, being an instrument of that relationship, the contractor, if you would, you know, went well because I had the authority of the college behind me and that worked well. I have been in, I've done some site visits at places where they've taken me to lunch, and you walk into a lunchroom, this is a long time ago, and you're sitting there and you're saying, these people are not used to seeing someone like me in here, you know. And there's a joke around that said that whenever I found myself on these site visits in places like that, I would sit with my back to the wall. And that's absolutely true, you know, because I just didn't know. You know, because, you know, having someone like me involved with these individuals was different for the communities. But the communities actually responded to it as well. And so I think that there's a lot of reasonableness out there. And often that sense of reasonableness is being downplayed by the vocal minority that advocates, you know, against diversity and inclusion. But those things were small parts of the concerns that I had as I work with educational networks.
So going back, I guess, to your student experiences, at one point you met Dr. Spearman and you all became friends. Do you remember that moment when you both became friends?
Yeah, I do. So Ron is a Morehouse guy.
You know? Okay.
And so I am the guy who went to Mercer. Mm-hmm. In fact, he's from Macon. He didn't go to Mercer.
Oh, wow.
He went to Morehouse, you know. So, you know, so even though I had this experience in an undergraduate, previously all-white institution, and he had gone to one of the most historic HBCUs in existence, there was Ron had this air about him that indicated that, you know, that, you know, that, you know, he had, you know, he had been at the foot of Martin Luther King and whatever and things like this. He was a proud Morehouse guy. And so so I kind of got that sense of him from the very beginning of being competitive, you know, committed to study, a serious student. But he was also somebody who always wanted to kind of be the one who introduces you to something new. And so it was Ron Spearman who showed me where they stored all of the cadavers for dissection in the old administration building. So we walk into this place, and I'm taking a gander, and Ron is acting like it's no big deal whatsoever. And I'm saying to myself, did I make the right decision to be here? But that was our first meeting, and because he stayed in the same dormitory on campus, let's call it Residence 4, as I did, we developed a real tight partnership because we actually participated that summer as summer preceptors for a program that was trying to introduce high school students and college students to opportunities in medical education. And so we were the preceptors that summer. So we had forged that relationship beforehand. And so when the classes started, you know, we became kind of the natural people who kind of facilitated the orientation of some of our African-American counterparts who were there that year, those the other five students who were coming on board. You always need someone who, you know, to suggest that we competed with each other is not what I want to say. But I gauged my readiness by how hard he studied, because if he's taking a weekend off, then maybe it's okay. If he's not taking a weekend off, you know, then you know he's having the same sort of feeling that we need to spend a little bit more time being prepared for the next examination and things like this. So I think that I kind of fed off of him a little bit. And looking at his style of study, that was a beneficial way for me to adapt in order to do well as well. So, colleagues and medical students, we grew into friendships, and I'm the godfather to his children, and he's the godfather to mine. That's so it's awesome. A longstanding productive relationship at all levels.
That's amazing to hear. And last question that I have for you before I let you go is that in this stage of career as a professor emeritus, like what do you look forward to? What's next for you in this chapter of life?
Well, I thought that the routine of being at home and traveling the world and things like that, that would be satisfying. And even though COVID prevented all of that, I recognize full well that being in retirement, that I have something to offer, and I'm anxious to offer it. So working in my church, because heretofore I did not have the time to do that. You know, I was one of those people who attended services, and that was about it. you know, paid my dues and things like that. You know, participated in the joint prayer and things of this nature. And now, just the mechanisms of how the institution works that, and things like this, to be a more participating partner of that. There are several community programs that are going on, like the efforts to revitalize the Laney Walker and Harrisburg community. I've had opportunities to participate in that because I, you know, there are those who feel that I bring a perspective of the city, having been a resident for my entire life, that's important to the way that they develop that. And right now, I'm actually doing a little bit of part-time work for the School of Medicine, doing, guess what? Building educational networks statewide.
Oh, wow.
For the entire medical school. So, so you know, I don't do this full-time because there is a benefit to retirement. You know, it reintroduces you to your wife, who becomes the toughest boss that you've ever worked for in your life and things like that. You know, it introduces you to family and things of this nature. And it also kind of gives you an opportunity to sit back and celebrate the accomplishments of others, like your children, people in the community, to be an advocate for those who are stepping into this path of medicine and healthcare for the first time, and being encouraging to them as well, trying to make sure that whatever legacy that you have is the legacy that is producing young people who are willing and able and not afraid to pursue these same sorts of careers.
Thank you so much for being here. I am feeling certainly inspired by all of what you shared today, and I hope everyone listening feels the same way.
I surely do as well, too.
If you have ever wanted to get hands-on with electronics, field biology, 3D printing, biochemistry, or other STEM-related activities, this is your chance. All AU students can participate in pop-up workshops. Opportunities for real-life application of STEM concepts and skills offered outside of the classroom, hosted by our own AU experts. In the past, Dr. Andy Hogger presented workshops covering the basics of computer programming, Arduino microcontrollers, tiny computers called Raspberry Pi, soldering, and much more. Other workshops led by chemists Dr. Panda, Maury, and yours truly, Dr. Spencer, uncovered the basics of bioinformatics, drug design, and enzymatic assays. We also have other STEM-related workshops covering a variety of mathematics and biology topics, in addition to workshops on careers in STEM, how to get involved in undergraduate research, and more. Don't miss out on this opportunity to learn skills that can help you navigate your STEM classes and prepare you for an exciting career in STEM. This is all possible based on funding from the National Science Foundation. Pick out the workshops that you are interested in by visiting our website today.
Welcome back, y'all, to In the Wild. And just continuing on with our Black History Month episode, we have a very special guest. He is a very accomplished physician and another alum of the Medical College of Georgia, and he's going to tell us a little bit about his experience. So give another warm Jaguar welcome to Dr. Ronald Spearman. How's it going?
Just fine, thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you for being here. Earlier, we talked to Dr. Hobbs, and he asked us to tell us about the story of how you two became friends. And so I wanted to get started with asking you the same question and hear your side to see if the story is matched up.
Well, that's a very interesting story. You know, over the years, Dr. Hobbs has become, you know, perhaps my closest friend. But it's really interesting. I came to Augusta the summer prior to the start of my medical school term, in the summer of 1970, as one of the first moderators for the Summer Educational Enrichment Program. And Dr. Hobbs has also had that position. We shared that position as the first two moderators. But I arrived a couple of weeks earlier, and I came from Morehouse, a Morehouse graduate, fraternity person. I was a fairly good pianist and knew a few popular tunes, and my thought was that I'm going to come to Augusta and put this place on the map. And so there were some students, nursing students and allied health students who were here at the time. And as I would, I guess, spread my wings, so to speak, or strut my feathers, you know, they would say, well, this is nice, but Dr. Hobbs worked in the lab with Dr. Wright. And after each accomplishment I would mention, they would give me all kinds of plaudits, but then say, "But Dr. Hobbs did this." So, in the back of my mind, it was, you know, well, who is this Joe Hobbs? And so I remember very distinctly being at the Student Center, which no longer is there now, but I was there at the pool table or the piano or something, and I happened to have been coming downstairs, and this person met me halfway up the stairs that I hadn't seen before, and something clicked and saying that maybe this is Dr. Hobbs, maybe this is Joe Hobbs, and he paused and looked, and we kind of stared at each other for about seemingly a long time. It must have been just a few seconds, but at any rate, I think that he probably had received some of the same input on the other end as I had, and it's kind of an issue of who was invading whose turf. But we greeted each other and then immediately recognized our similarities. And I had been in Augusta for a little while and knew a little bit about that. And he of course, had gone to Mercer and Macon, my hometown, and knew a lot about that. And we began to exchange experiences, and the friendship just mushroomed and grew from that point on.
That's awesome to hear. How would you say you each other were able to help each other and kind of grow through medical school? Because you came at a very interesting time as like still one of our first Black students.
Well, actually, 1970, the fall or summer of 1970, was really the precipice of the social and cultural revolution of the 1970s. And in fact, as I mentioned in an earlier interview, Augusta was just recovering from the big riot back in the 1970s, and it was, you know, a very interesting time, and a time of social and cultural revolution. Dr. Hobbs had come from Mercer University, which was a white, predominantly white institution. I'd come from Morehouse, and so we had different experiences, but they were complementary to each other. And as medical students, we worked very closely together. I wouldn't say that was exactly a rivalry per se, but I think we encouraged each other to do our best. And although we compared notes at the end of exams, we never withheld anything that would be of an advantage to each other. We always worked, you know, very synergistically over that period of time. And so, I mean, there were other things in the environment that enhanced it as well, but that was the dynamic between the two of us.
Yeah, you guys kind of met, like, you know, kind of felt like you guys were competing against each other. But in reality, you guys were both, you know, going to school for the same purpose. You guys were, you know, two minorities, and you guys wanted to, you know, prove to your white counterparts that you were intelligent and that you could do, you know, the same thing that they can do. So I like how you guys kind of started off like a little competitive, but then you guys realized, like, you started to help each other out because you guys were, you know, going for the same purpose.
Well, absolutely. I mean, yeah. And that was, you know, we would never allow either one of us to be at a disadvantage in terms of resources, right, and wherewithal. You know, we were extremely supportive of each other in that regard. And I think that the fact that we both wanted to do well was just an incentive, a very mm-hmm. positive incentive, you know, that spurred us on to achieve it at our highest levels, our highest level possible.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about your career here at the university, because you accomplished so much while you were here. So let's talk about some of your just, I guess, personal career highlights.
Well, at the time, as a medical student, we were still in the very, I guess, in the third class, you know, coming in. Doctors John Harp and Frank Rumpf, you know, were in the initial class that entered in 1967, and then Dr. Tommy Leonard entered in 1969, the year before us. So those were inspirations in many ways. I think Doctors Harp and Rumpf, you know, cracked the ceiling and just proved the fact that, you know, that African Americans, you know, would do well and thrive. And then Dr. Leonard, who was just a year ahead of us, was able to impart a more immediate knowledge of what to expect. And so those were very positive experiences, you know, from that standpoint of view. But from an individual perspective, I guess probably the most significant thing in the early phase was of medical school was that I was appointed as a voting member of the admissions committee. That was a relatively new process at the time. I think it had been in effect for maybe a couple of years of having a student as a voting member of the committee, and I had the privilege of being selected to do that, perform that, and out of the positive experiences in medical school, I decided to stay on and do my residency at the Medical College of Georgia. After having had some opportunities to do that perform my residency at some other creditable institutions. But I'm just going to back up just a little bit and talk a little bit about those 4 years. As I mentioned, you know, we were in the middle of the Renaissance, and there were faculty members, particularly those members who were a part of the summer educational enrichment program, that were very forward in their thinking in terms of enhancing the experience of minority students as they entered or prepared to enter medical school. And there was an eclectic group of faculty, some of whom, you know, I think were very proactive in that regard as well. But there were some challenges, I would say, in those early years. I can remember in the first year when we were doing the anatomy class, you know, gross anatomy consisted of working with cadavers as the laboratory part of that, and as it turned out, all the black students worked on the cadaver. We were all our partners and worked on the cadaver, and that was just, I guess, something that was expected. It wasn't frowned upon, but you know, we hung together in that regard. And as time went on, there were some positive overtures from certain groups. Certain fraternities would invite us to some social functions, and then there were others that, you know, would not consider that, and we'd recognize that and moved on with that. In my clinical years, I can recall an experience on the OBGYN rotation where we were in clinic and one of the resident staff just very candidly told me that I think it's a good idea for you not to go in the room at this time for seeing this patient, because we were seeing some patients from South Georgia, and they just thought that was not a good idea. Considering the time, and I didn't process that, although that's certainly something that would not be acceptable under any circumstances now, but that's just an example of how things were, you know, at that point in time. And there was also, I think, an air of skepticism that persisted for a few years beyond that. I can remember on another clinical rotation where one of the secretaries was very interested and allowed me to look at some of the subjective evaluations. We were graded then based upon subjective evaluations, 50% upon subjective evaluations, and another 50% based on exams, you know, written oral examinations. And I can remember this particular rotation in which I had an interest and did some extra reading and work, you know, to do well with that. And when the subjective comments were collected, they were submitted, you know, in a kind of a round table manner by faculty and residents who were working. And I can remember I looked at my card, and one comment said that did so well that I didn't notice he was black.
Oh, whoa!
So that again shows that, you know, that there was some that was a learning curve, so to speak, that had to be accomplished at that point in time. And again, I don't think that that's anything that would, you know, that would be even remotely like that now. But those were some of the experiences in those early years. But I think the desire and the zeal to accomplish supervened over those things, and by at the end of the 4 years, I thought that it was a net positive experience, to the extent that I, as I mentioned earlier, that I opted to apply for my residency and continued on here. After starting the residency, I had the privilege of being selected as the first black chief resident in internal medicine, and I guess as a result of that, I was offered a faculty position. And came on as an assistant professor of internal medicine, and which, along with Dr. Hobbs, who was in family medicine at the time. We were both the first full-time African-American faculty members, academic faculty members at that time. That experience was a good one, but after a few years, I yielded to that innate call to become a frontline provider. And so after 7 years on the faculty, I spent 24 years in private practice of internal medicine in Augusta, which was a tremendous experience in allowing me to practice my craft and at the same time become involved in the community. That was probably one of the fondest memories that I have of my career. And even now, after closing my practice in 2008 and transitioning to the VA, that I'll mention in a minute, it's kind of interesting now that my daughter, who is credentialed both in internal medicine and psychiatry, is now seeing some of the patients that I...
Oh, wow.
So that happens from time to time. But after the 24 years in private practice, an opportunity became available to work at the VA. And medicine had changed to some degree at that time. I was doing a classic solo practice of internal medicine, and the paradigm has shifted now. I think that very few, if any, people are doing it that way now, and just because of the way that things have changed with regard to practice patterns, and now that most people are working either in much larger groups or working in for institutions. And so I was at that crossroads at the time, and the opportunity for the VA to come to the VA became available, and I opted to go that way and spent the next 11 and a half years working in the spinal cord injury unit at the downtown VA here in Augusta, basically practicing internal medicine as it pertained to spinal cord injury patients, which was a slightly different nuance from what I had done, but very rewarding and I think also an appropriate and a very positive part of my overall career. And I retired from that practice just over 2 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay. But going back to something that you said earlier about kind of experiencing, some microaggressions from when you were practicing here as, I guess, a resident, how did you cope when, you had to deal with someone leaving a note card saying, oh, he performed so well, I didn't even notice that he was black, or having to sit out of interacting with patients based off of them being racist or having certain preferences. How did you cope in those moments?
Well, those were in the student years, and of course, we probably didn't have the opportunity that we would have now. I mean, that would have in a higher position as a resident or as a practitioner, to confront that, but. That was so early in the course until it was kind of an expectation that, well, it was not a great surprise. And I guess I had, that was within the range of tolerance that I had at that particular point in time, realizing how new the experience was. So those were things that were not unexpected. And I think, as time went on and as I and others after me and as well as some before me were able to vindicate ourselves as people with significant achievement, then those it kind of took care of itself.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And how does it feel to have a daughter who is double board certified and, I guess, in a way following your footsteps of serving at your alma mater?
Well, needless to say, I'm extremely proud of her. And, of course, she says that she admits that she has one up on me because she's double boarded her both. But I'm very proud of her and both her mother and I. And of course, I'd be remiss in not mentioning that that a big part of my undergraduate experience at medical school was, of course, meeting my wife, who was in dental school at the same time. She enrolled in dental school as I was a third year student, and of course, we. Helped each other a lot during that time, and she ultimately came to Augusta and established a practice for many, many years before her retirement, a very successful practice. And so, yeah, but we are both extremely proud of my daughter, and I'm 100% supportive of her and just happy to see that she is doing well in the academic sphere, and we're just very proud of that.
Last year when your daughter was on the show, I asked her, what is it like to have so many doctors in the same family? So now I have to ask, now that I have you here, I have to ask you, what is it like to have so many doctors in the family? Are you diagnosing each other all the time? Or like how do your dinner table conversations go without bringing work home?
Well, we talk about it some, but I think that we pace ourselves in that regard. It's helpful when there are issues that come up. It gives that we can be sounding boards for each other and get perspectives on that. With my daughter, I kind of kid her sometimes. I'm saying that she has an edge on me with regard to the currency of information and the recent things, and then my forte is with experience. But I think that there's a symbiosis there, and of course, you know, my wife is very astute in her area, and then having been exposed to a medicine, she has, you know, an uncanny ability to take in information and synthesize that, and a lot of times her insights are very pervasive and very thought provoking as well. So, doesn't dominate our experiences, and we have other interests that we like to pursue and talk about.
When you look back, or when you look at the university now, from your perspective, how do you think the university has changed, especially in terms of just being more diverse or inclusive?
I think it's changed significantly for the better, and I'm sure that there are probably areas, you know, for continued improvement, but I think that the playing field is much more level now with regard to the expectations of African Americans when they come there. I don't think that there is this doubt or a question as to how well a person is going to do. I think I think most students and most residents, faculty, you know, have a reasonable opportunity to start, you know, at a point and be recognized, you know, for their abilities and to achieve it, much more so than in my era. As I mentioned, I'm sure that there are still instances in which things could be improved, but I think it has gotten a lot better than it was 50 years ago.
You know, what advice could you give to students who maybe the only person, you know, or that a minority in a program, you know, what would you give advice to a student who doesn't see students in the program that they're in that doesn't look like them?
Well, I think that just to use an overworked phrase, you know, keeping your eye on the ball, I mean, realizing what you're there for. And staying focused on that. I think that, you know, to become too distracted really, you know, can be harmful in terms of your process. I think that in time, as you perform and do well, your efforts are going to be vindicated appropriately. But I think that when you get too distracted by things that you might perceive as not quite above board or quite, that can be detrimental to your forward progress.
And I guess last question before I let you go, now that you are retired, how do you like to spend your time? What do you like to do to stay inspired?
Well, one answer used to be that I like to do what I want to do when I want to do it, the way I want to do it. But realistically, though, that's a kind of an interesting question. In the maybe 6 to 9 months before my retirement, when I had actually made the announcement that I was going to retire, I had a fair amount of angst in terms of how I would spend my time, and I had considered some part-time opportunities, teaching opportunities, perhaps residency teaching and that sort of thing. and that was just prior to the onset of the pandemic. And of course, because I retired at the end of December in 2019. And so that the things were a little bit more difficult to come to fruition because of that, because of those situations. But it didn't take very long after being out that I had the epiphany that I had a great career as an eclectic career as an academician, as a practitioner in private practice and the VA, and I felt very good about that, and I had become involved with in an advisor capacity for some organizations that allowed me to draw on my experiences and that I had as a practitioner or and in the various capacities, and also I am heavily involved in grandparenting, which is a pleasure that I tremendously enjoy because of have the ability to have the freedom and opportunity to along with my wife, to do that, and so as I explained to some of my former members, former patients rather, who were members of my church, that it was I had the epiphany that it's an ecclesiastical sort of thing, and a time and place. And so, so between my work with the Medical College of Georgia Foundation and serving in an advisory capacity for some other medical advisory capacity for other organizations, and my church, and being the chairman of the health commission there and helping to navigate things through the pandemic. I've been busy enough, and I've had some other hobbies and with music, and I like to tinker with my cars. I've had a passion for automobiles for a long time. So I just enjoy the opportunity to do things without the duress of making deadlines.
Oh, yeah.
I can't wait for that.
Yes, because Ania is going to get ready to graduate later this year.
Yes, yeah. In December.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel you on that. Thank you so much for being here and sharing your experiences with us, because I'm feeling super inspired by you and for Dr. Hobbs coming to talk to us about your careers, your amazing, awe-inspiring careers.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, and I wish the best of luck to both of you as you move forward.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to In the Wild. If you like what you heard, then give a nice rating and review to this podcast on whatever you use to listen to your podcast. To keep our conversations going, follow In the Wild on Instagram at In the Wild Pod and Augusta University on all social media platforms. Don't forget to follow me, your host, Rayshawn Ricks, at Rayshawn Ricks, to send me questions you want to see answered on the show. Tune in for new episodes every week because we don't want you to miss a single thing that's happening on campus. You can also find out more news at jaguar.augusta.edu. Until then, I'll see y'all next time. Stay wild.